I do want to thank Pastor for giving me the opportunity, as he so eloquently puts, when you have questions or want to do something in church, well, you do it. So I had a question about the Maccabean Revolt. So he said, "Great, why don't you study that, and then you can just tell us what you find." So I am very excited to go through this. It's been something that I haven't known very much about, except for just kind of a surface understanding that it took place, and that you know, essentially just that the first and second Maccabees are part of the Apocrypha, and so I think there's a certain amount, rightly, of stigma that comes with you know, the Roman Catholic canon, but at the same time, first Maccabees in particular, second Maccabees not so much, but the first one is pretty historically accurate and provides a lot of good context for us, and I think that is what Pastor was talking about in the introduction. It's about context and understanding just exactly what Jesus was being born into, and sort of the feelings of the Jewish people around this time. So I do want to, we're going to go through the goals, but just as a reminder, I want to, you know, just say, if you would please not record personally anything, and just for the purpose of the fact that I am a history teacher, and I don't want, you know, I want to control sort of the audio that's so if you would like access to the recording, it is going to be recorded, but I am teaching today as a member of Westside, not as in my position as a history teacher at Weld Central, so just that's more of a legal note as opposed to anything else, but so goals for the lesson. The first thing that we want to look at is just to understand the revolt historically. So what do we know from primary sources? What do we know from secondary sources? Primary sources being those historical sources that are from the time period that we're studying. Secondary sources being secondhand information, so somebody else studies it and then presents the information. So to the best of our knowledge, First Maccabees would be the best primary source for that period. And then there are, of course, several different secondary sources, both print sources and online. We're going to compare it to other revolutions. If we have time, as I was going through this, I do want to have some time for questions and discussions. So if we don't have the time to compare it to the French Revolution, the American Revolution, Simon Bolivar's revolutions in South America, you know, there's a pretty good chance we may not have that opportunity. And then, of course, the question that we have really been pursuing ever since I started back in the summer, and then throughout my series, and then Pastor's series, justification. So based on what we know from it, and based on what we have studied from the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and then the series that Pastor just went through, can we biblically justify what the Maccabees did in their revolt against the Seleucid Empire? One thing that I think is going to be super helpful, that I found very helpful to myself, is to create a timeline of important events. So if you're following along in your notes, drawing a timeline would help, but, you know, just these dates correspond with, you know, these important events. So first of all, we have Alexander the Great's death and the Jews being ruled by the Ptolemies. So just in a very brief history, Alexander the Great conquers the known world in his early 30s. Or right around the age of 30, Alexander the Great dies of an unknown illness. He was actually a pretty good leader, politically speaking. So if you look at other empires throughout history, pretty negative people are leading, pretty bad people are leading those empires. Alexander the Great would probably fall more under the category of a, well, during the Enlightenment, they were called enlightened despots. Which is kind of funny, because despot is typically a negative connotation, and enlightened tends to be more of a positive. But Alexander the Great, you know, precursing that term, could be considered kind of an enlightened despot. He allowed a lot of independence within his empire, which is why during his life he was able to keep it together. Typically, heavy-handed empires are the ones that fall the quickest, and that's true of the Roman Empire as well. So Alexander the Great dies, and then his empire is divided into four or five different empires that are then ruled by four different empires that are then ruled by his generals. And the Ptolemies are the ones that are going to rule Egypt and then into Palestine as well. The Ptolemies actually were a pretty, were almost modeling their government after Alexander the Great's because they allowed the Jews, again, a lot of autonomy. So the Jews were continually practicing their biblical traditions. They were still allowed to follow the laws of Moses. And so in that regard, the Ptolemies, like Alexander the Great, who, you know, that transition, you have two different rulers in Palestine, both of them are allowing the Jews to continue their practices. And that's an important point, that the Jews have become accustomed to being ruled by a foreign power, but those powers have allowed them to continue their religious practices. And then, unfortunately for the Jews, the Ptolemies are defeated by the Seleucid Empire, which is more the Middle Eastern portion of Alexander the Great's empire. And the Seleucids, they're not nearly as friendly as the Ptolemies were, and certainly not as friendly as Alexander the Great was. So what happens is the Seleucid Empire goes on this approach of enforcing Hellenistic type of culture, and this is where Mattathias, the father of Judas Maccabeus, refuses to sacrifice to those gods, and the revolt begins. I will expand on all of this stuff here in a minute, or expound, I should say. Then in 165 BC, Judah, or Judas, who is known as Maccabeus, he retakes Jerusalem and consecrates the temple, and that actually happens on December 25th. So that's kind of an interesting coincidence. We celebrate the birth of Jesus, but you know, around this time, of course, Hanukkah is celebrated, but it's on Christmas that Judah consecrates the temple and completes really the whole goal of the revolt. And then the Hasmonean dynasty reigns over an independent Jewish nation. That is the name for the Maccabees, so it's referring to Judah as his position as king, and then his brothers, who I believe two of them reign following him, and then it just kind of goes down the line. So for about 100 years, they will rule over the Jewish nation until the reign of Herod the Great. So that gets us pretty much right up to the birth of Jesus, which is, again, provides great context for what we're talking about. In true Unruh fashion, I have alliterated all my points. So I wasn't going to do that, and that was initially titled The Revolt Begins, but then the last two also started with C. And I was like, I need to find a synonym for begins, because otherwise I know that he would have given me a hard time. He's like, you could have alliterated it. All right, now it's alliterated, and we'll that'll kind of help us probably with memory. So the revolt commences with Seleucid leader Antiochus III and his strict and rigid enforcement of Hellenistic, which is another word for Greek culture and religion. Just kind of in a broad sense, Western culture is based on Hellenistic culture. So as Americans, we typically don't have a negative idea of the way that the Greeks structured their government, their society. But, of course, we are also aware that Greek culture and religion is pagan. And so there's a lot of things that takes place within Greek society that are not, you know, are not even fit to discuss, really, at any time except in a strictly academic thing that the Greeks support and encourage. So, and that includes homosexuality. So with the enforcement of Antiochus III, or with his enforcement of Greek culture and religion, he is trying to elevate himself to the status of Alexander the Great. Okay, and that's the whole reason behind him being so rigid in what he expects out of his subjects. So once the Seleucid Empire defeats the Ptolemies, Antiochus III wants to make a name for himself in the history books that is on par with Alexander the Great. And he feels that the way in which Alexander the Great failed was in allowing his subjects that autonomy, that independence, to keep their culture and their religion. So that's why Antiochus III is going throughout all of his newly gathered empire and strictly enforcing, saying, you have to adopt Greek culture and religion. And many Jews are going to be okay with this. And they submit to the laws. And based on what I saw, it could be out of fear of repercussions, but a lot of it was just out of not caring. just kind of indifference, because initially there wasn't a forceful, you know, you don't have security forces watching everybody. They build a gymnasium next to the temple. And according to Greek culture, everyone that is in that gymnasium has to be nude, okay? Because, again, that's all about Greek and Hellenistic culture. Obviously, for a Jew, that is not going to be allowed. And so there's a reason Antiochus builds this gymnasium next to the temple, because it's a slap in the face to traditional Judaism and their religion. And he also begins to require people to use the gymnasium at least once a week. And of course, if you're a Jew and you aren't allowed religiously to use the gymnasium, but you're being ordered to legally, a lot of them just do it. And of course, this creates quite a divide between those Jews that are strict in the sense of they're following the laws of Moses, and those that are essentially just becoming Jews in name only. Excuse me. Mattathias is the priest of, Pastor, do you know how to pronounce this? So it's, I believe it's Modine, is probably going to be the Anglican pronunciation of it. And believe it might be Modine today. I think the N dropped and it's pronounced with an M today. But he's the priest of this city. It's a very small city at the time. Today, the city kept its original name. As I said, it's Modim, but then it also includes the name Maccabeus in it as well, which is interesting. And he's ordered by an officer of the Seleucids, one of King Antiochus's officers, to sacrifice an animal to the Greek gods to show his allegiance. So they know that Mattathias is the high priest of this region for this town, and he's responsible for carrying out the Hebrew traditional sacrifices according to the laws of Moses. And this officer is demanding him, he's telling him, you need to show your allegiance to your new king, sacrifice on this altar to the Greek gods. And he refuses. At what takes place next is kind of where we begin to see some of, we begin to ask ourselves, is this justified? So Mattathias says he will not perform that act. Another Jew from the city steps forward to carry out this act, at which point Mattathias kills him and subsequently kills the king's officer who is ordering them to do this. And according to 1 Maccabees 2:27, Mattathias becomes filled with zeal for the law of Moses, and after he kills these two men, says, let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me. So it's kind of this, according to the book, 1 Maccabees, it's kind of this heroic stand of this man who is burning with hatred for the defilement of his religion and of his God, and even to the point where he is willing to kill one of his fellow townsfolk for trying to carry out this thing that would be considered a desecration to God. Okay, so the revolt continues, and what happens is Mattathias and his sons, they flee to the hills around Modine because they know that there's going to be a response. Okay, so Mattathias is not doing this out of ignorance. He's not thinking, oh, I'm going to get away with this. He knows immediately that there are going to be armies that are sent to Modine, that they're going to hunt him down. And so what he's doing is trying to take a defensive posture to that possibility, as opposed to getting himself and probably most of the other people that are loyal to him in the town killed by just staying there. Other townspeople are leaving as well, but they're not in the same place as Mattathias. So you can think of this as kind of two groups of people. This second group is filled with very, very devout people who follow the law of Moses to a T. And this ultimately leads to their death, because what happens is the Seleucid soldiers that march on Modine find this group of townsfolk that are, again, separate. Mattathias and his sons are not in the picture here. Finds them in the hills and begins to posture themselves for battle. And these Jews refuse to fight these Seleucid army, or this Seleucid army, because it's on the Sabbath. So according to the law of Moses, they said, you can come up and you can kill us, essentially, but we're not going to fight back at all because we will die following the law of Moses. And so that's exactly what happens, and they're absolutely slaughtered. The word of this incident gets to Mattathias, and he immediately says, my group is not going to take that posture. And he's basically saying, you know, back in the Old Testament days, the Jews were expected to defend themselves at all times, and we're going to do the same thing. If that means that we have to fight on the Sabbath, then we're going to do so, and we're going to do so with what he feels is a religious exemption for that law, that it's not considered work, but they are carrying out the will of God, essentially. And so if that takes place on the Sabbath, then he's not going to get himself slaughtered by keeping that rule. Mattathias is not responsible for the victory of the Maccabean revolt because he dies and his son Judas is the one that continues the fight. Judas will reign after he consecrates the temple. He'll reign for about 5 years, then he's killed in battle, and then his brother Jonathan takes over. Judas is the epicenter of the Maccabean revolt. His nickname is Maccabeus, which there's really no direct translation from the Hebrew to our language, but it has the idea of someone who is stamping out the enemy, and so it's translated pretty loosely as hammer, which is a really good nickname for somebody who's a man of war. This will become the Jewish name for the family. And so sometimes Mattathias is considered one of the Maccabees. His brothers are considered one of the Maccabees. So it becomes kind of this universal term. And of course, it's the name for the revolt as a whole. So it's the Maccabean or the Maccabean revolt. All right, the revolt concludes, at least in its initial stages, under Judas. And he is known, it's actually very convenient, if that's the right word, that pastor preached about Joshua and his practices. I don't know what's going on with this. But Joshua was tasked with completely annihilating basically every enemy of the Lord that stood in the way. And Judas undertakes the exact same approach. So once again, this is sort of the controversy around the Maccabean revolt as well, something that we're going to have to work through as we talk about whether or not it's justified, because there are some practices in his complete annihilation of not just the Seleucid armies that come out to face him, but also any Jews that have adopted this Hellenistic type of lifestyle. And so, much like his father, he is filled with zeal for the law of Moses, but is this an appropriate way for him to carry it out? That is a debatable question. So he defeats a greatly superior force of the Seleucids in one of the final battles before the city of Jerusalem is retaken. The tradition says that the Maccabees are outnumbered like 5-1, and Judas is an excellent military leader, brilliant in battle, and so he's able to utilize his forces, even outnumbered 5-1, and defeat the Seleucid army. Initially, the reason that he gains so much traction is because he's able to recruit, obviously, a lot of Jews to his army, but also because the Seleucids don't take him seriously. So they think that they can just kind of send out their second-best generals, give them some battle experience, put down this revolt very easily, and they underestimate him. Well, in this case, this battle that predates the capture of Jerusalem by Judas, they send out a very, very large force. Once and for all, they're going to eliminate the Maccabees, and they're going to put out this revolt, and it fails. So after defeating this superior force, Jerusalem is now under the control of Judas, and this is where you get the tradition of Hanukkah. So the menorah that's used in the process of rededication needed to stay lit for 8 straight days for the temple to be rededicated, but because there was a shortage of oil for that lamp, they were just going to burn it as long as they could, and they weren't going to be able to get any more oil until that 8 days had passed. But according to Jewish tradition, the menorah stays lit for that entire time, seen as a miracle of God and God's blessing on their rededicating the temple and cleansing it. So this is where we have the festival of Hanukkah that is still celebrated today. And of course, as I mentioned before, because this rededication begins on, and Mrs. Ortel, you may have to correct me here, it begins on the 24th or concludes on the 20th? And I did know that it started somewhere before, but it is December 25th, historically speaking, that the temple is considered rededicated. So I don't know if it began 8 days before that or how it initially was.
I think it was right
in the middle. It's in the middle. So, but anyway, December 25th, our traditional holiday of Christmas, is the date that that Judas is in control of Jerusalem and the temple. So Judas dies in battle, and then his brother Jonathan dies in battle, and then under his other brother, whose name escapes me now, the Seleucids are done. They grant their freedom. They grant freedom to Judea and allow them to continue their sacrifices, and they're not going to impose the Hellenistic culture upon them anymore. So the fighting is over, and this is where the Hasmonean dynasty is completely, you know, kind of ingrained into the Jewish political climate. And as I said, the next 100 years is going to belong to the Hasmonean line and will only end with the reign of Herod the Great. Any questions about that process? So the commencement, the continuation, or the conclusion? Yes.
So that last bullet point, Herod is actually an extension of this Judas magnification.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
No, so the line continues until the reign of Herod the Great. So Herod the Great, essentially, his reign ends the Hasmonean line.
All right.
And the name Hasmonean comes from another interpretation of some. It's kind of obscure how they historically have named it. It makes way more sense to call it the Maccabean line, but the Hasmonean line is the Maccabean line. It's the line of Judas and his brothers, and then whoever is the next relative to take the throne. Because after Judas and all his brothers die, there's no more brothers. And so it just continues in the traditional hereditary right of kings, as we saw throughout our study of ancient Europe, or not ancient, but 1600s Europe. Yes?
One of the brothers was Aslan. Okay, and that's where Hasmonean comes from.
There you go. One very interesting thing that I found was that at one point, after Judas's death, and I believe it's under Jonathan, this is discussed in the 5th or 6th chapter of 1 Maccabees, the Maccabees write to the Greek city-state of Sparta and say, we actually share lineage somewhere down the line, and we would like your support in our fight against, our continuing fight against the Seleucid Empire. We think that we have, common goals here. And so I've always been fascinated with the city-state of Sparta and its, strict military. And so to find this, you go, wow, well, that is such a weird combination of, because they're fighting against the Seleucids, which is and they're imposing Greek culture, and they go to a Greek city-state, one at which is extremely Hellenistic, of Sparta, and you have this alliance between these two governments. And they also write to Jews that live in Egypt that are part of that portion of the Seleucid Empire. And elicit their help as well. And so you have a lot of Jews throughout Alexander the Great's empire, former empire, that are in support of this movement. So it's not just, it starts very localized in the city of Modin, and then expands to Because once that temple is rededicated, the Jews, of course, are going to support that 100%. And so all the people of the, you know, of Judaism that are in the Seleucid Empire will begin to support more and more what the Maccabees are doing. And so they're allowed there, that allows them to recruit more and more people to the army. And it gets to the point where, you know, with that third bullet point, that the Seleucids are like, yeah, we can't do this anymore. This is becoming a war against an actual nation as opposed to trying to put down a revolt. And that's it. Yes, ma'am. I think you were looking at slides that have not come up yet, because that's exactly what we're going to talk about. So great job. Yeah, that is going to be an application. So yeah, so you could just hold on to that point, because it's going to be perfect for when we discuss that. Some questions of justification that I came up with. First of all, did God expect Mattathias to sacrifice to the Greek gods because the political authority commanded it? Because that's where the revolt begins. So if we're going to look at revolutions, as we did with the American Revolution and the French Revolution, go to the root cause of the revolution. And if you can justify that root cause, then it's much easier to justify what takes place afterwards. And once again, as I said during the summer, I'm not of the mindset that the ends justify the means, but what are the ends? What is it that the Maccabees are trying to accomplish in their revolt? So the question must be, if we're going to the root cause of the revolution, is that justified? Did God expect Mattathias to obey the political authority and sacrifice to the Hellenistic gods on an altar that was dedicated to him? And I think obviously the answer is no. So Mattathias is not wrong in refusing the order from the government that requires him to disobey the law of Moses. Can we agree on that? Okay, are there any questions? Because I want to make sure, like, we're all in the same spot, because I arrived at the conclusion, based on what Pastor, his series after mine, that God would not have expected obedience to this order, even though it did come from a political authority. Okay, was the Seleucid authority fulfilling God's expectations of government? And that's just my abbreviation of government. So according to Romans 13, are they lovers of good and enemies of evil? Obviously, the answer, once again, would be no. So the Seleucid authority was in the wrong, and Mattathias, by refusing, now I haven't gotten to the violence part yet, but in his refusal, is he justified, and is the Seleucid authority wrong in opposition to God? I think historically we can say yes, that is the case. If you build a gymnasium right next to the Temple Mount and force Jews to disobey the law of God, remember, this predates Jesus, so it's not as though, you know, the law has been abolished. Jews are still expected to follow it. That seems very, very easy to say. Antiochus III was not a godly man. He was not a godly authority, and he was not fulfilling God's expectation of what a government should be. How does this compare to Jesus' response to defiling of the temple? So if you would take your Bibles and open to Mark 12, let's take a look at this passage, because this is one of the first things that I thought of when I was looking at this. Because there are some similarities that we can draw here. Jesus is... And I have to find the verse in which this happens. Was this the right chapter? Do I have the wrong chapter up there?
Are you looking about the cleansing of the temple?
Yeah. Was it? Because I'm not seeing it here. The resource that I used must have given me the wrong reference. Let's go to John. John. Mark 11, okay. Thank you. All right. So the similarity that I'm finding here between these two events, Mattathias refusing to desecrate the altar of God by sacrificing to the Greek gods, and Jesus responding to the defilement of the temple for essentially what amounts to a similar reason, because he feels that the temple has been defiled by these people. So in Mark 11, 15, it says, "And they came to Jerusalem, and Jesus went into the temple and began to cast them out that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves, and would not suffer that any man should carry any vessel through the temple. And he taught, saying unto them, Is it not written, My house shall be called of all nations the house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves? And the scribes and the chief priests heard it, and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all people was astonished at his doctrine. And when even was come, he went out of the city." So John 2 would be the parallel passage in which it actually describes the manner in which Jesus carries this out, and he makes a whip and drives people out violently from the temple. This process would have taken more than just a couple minutes. The temple complex was pretty large, and so if within the borders of the temple, you have several people that are changed, it's not going to be like five people that Jesus is driving out. So this could have taken quite some time and would have made quite a scene within the temple, because this tradition had been, you know, around for a long time. Is Jesus' response to the defiling of the temple by the money changers, is that an incorrect response? Clearly not, because we know that Jesus is perfect. So this passage is great because Jesus is using violence, as he himself is filled with the zeal of the Lord, or zeal for the law of the Lord, because he quotes it there. Is it not written, My house shall be called of all nations the house of prayer, and drives people out of the temple. Now, he doesn't kill anyone. So in that way, we can't have a, you know, exact comparison. But I thought it was interesting that in both cases, Jesus is not asking politely. If someone is asking God or doing something that makes God's presence or something that God has called sacred defiled, then the response, according to Jesus, seems to be justified. That we're not to place kindness as a top priority in that situation. Yes? Legally speaking, and another argument you could probably make is, legally, are the money changers legally allowed to do that? Obviously they are. So there's, you know, you could come back with that. You know, they're following the law, and Jesus is saying don't do that, because they're not following the law of Scripture. But it's not a direct comparison because of the fact that no two events in history are the exact same. And what you're trying to find is things that help us to better understand and justify the actions of Mattathias, and that's just going to be very difficult to do. Yes?
What is delegated to the Jews by the Roman authorities? Do they allow them to run this with their council?
But it wasn't... Yeah, because the government is not directly ordering people sell stuff in the temple complex. Yes.
Well, I'm just going to say that they weren't in the temple. This is a loophole that they had there. Okay, they were in the court of the Gentiles on the court. And that is what the court of the
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, Jesus is using, he says, is it not written, my house shall be called of all nations the house of prayer? And I don't have the, passage in front of me that he's quoting, but I think that that's important as well. And that you're exactly right, but that's also why I use the term temple complex. So it's the comp, they're not within the walls of the temple doing this. Because the temple itself is relatively small compared to the actual complex where people are actually allowed, because nobody's actually allowed inside the temple except the high priest. Do you have a question?
Not necessarily a question, but it's also just interesting to compare Judas's response to what he would have known in the Bible. Like, as far as Jewish history goes, probably the most recent record of people who had to defy authority would have been Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel. He would have known what they did.
So when does God condone the enforcement of his law in a violent way versus more like a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego way, where it's, what do they call it? Gandhi made this famous. Civil disobedience, essentially. Yeah. Context is so important. You have to understand that when you try to, because I do this in my history class all the time, we want to find parallels to a historical event so we can better understand it. And that's a good practice, but it's also, you have to be very careful in what you're doing. Because as Pastor pointed out, this is definitely not apples to apples. Okay? This is a similar situation with a slightly similar response, but it's not the same. Jesus was not in the position of Mattathias being asked to defile the altar of God, and we can not definitively say that Jesus would have responded the exact same way that Mattathias did, because Jesus never did that, right? And so the same thing is true across the entire historical timeline, everything that we know about history. Because we go, well, if I was President Truman, I wouldn't have dropped the bombs on Japan. Well, we'll never know that because you'll never be President Truman and you'll never be tasked with ending World War II, right? So we're arguing something that's moral, whether something is moral or not, because that's the root question. Is what Mattathias and his sons do, is it moral? Is it within the, you know, what is right for a Christian or a Jew in this case to respond? But we'll never know. So the best that we can do is say, what would we do in that situation? If you're Mattathias, what would you have done? Yes.
Well, you wrote to this first about what Mattathias did. I thought of Numbers 25 that the made reference to the son or the grandson of Aaron. His name is Phinehas. It's in Numbers 25. And what he did was tremendously violent in defense.
So,
and as a result, God blesses Phinehas for what he did.
So here's my question. Did God outright command Phinehas to do that? Because that's what people always say about the Israelites. Well, the difference between what the Israelites do in Canaan and the difference in, like, the American Revolution is that God specifically is commanding them to do that, so they're carrying it out. But we have instances like that where God is not specifically commanding people to be violent, and that's how they respond. And apparently that's in a godly way because God blesses him. So did God bless Mattathias and the Maccabees? It's hard to say because historically speaking, they are successful and they do reconsecrate the temple, which would please God. But in the manner in which they do that, does that please God?
And you've got the difference of theocratic Israel, Phinehas.
Mm-hmm.
Now Israel, under the authority of the
Correct. So once again, it's not apples to apples. So it's helping us to understand it, but it's not giving us the straight answer. Okay. And I hate it when I have to do this, because I don't like being, to borrow a term, the devil's advocate. I want to arrive at a conclusion. The problem is in situations like this, a lot of us have to arrive at our own conclusions, as opposed to me standing up here in a position of biblical teaching saying, this is how you need to feel about it. Okay, so here are my concerns, and they will echo what Mrs. Ortel was saying previously, and that is that I am not sure that there are a lot of Christians that would be filled with such zeal for the law of God and for God himself that they would, if this is a correct response, that they would carry this out. So my concern in studying this is, if in fact the Maccabees were justified in this, then are we going to get to a point where it's expected of us, and yet we do not fulfill those expectations? Now, again, that doesn't mean that it has to be some sort of violent rampage or something like that, because that would be obviously an inappropriate response to a lot of different things. However, if it is in the Bible that sometimes is the case, when we're put in that position, how would we respond? And would we respond in a godly way? So just a couple points quickly before we get to our discussion, and some passages of scripture that I thought of. The God of the Old Testament is the same as the God of the New Testament. So we can't say, well, the God of the Old Testament was a God of war, but the God of the New Testament isn't, because that's not true. And our lives are balanced between things like Christian liberty and separation, and also passages that talk about love for our enemies, but also a response to their sin that is maybe not presented in a way that the world would say is loving. However, it is done out of love, right? So we are, you know, saying, you know, this needs to be eradicated from your life, or you shouldn't be doing this. And then the other thing is that, you know, things that seem to not make sense to us, God is both a God of order, as it says in 1 Corinthians 14:33, but he's also a God of judgment and of war. Right? Exodus 15:3 says that the Lord is a man of war. So are we to believe that that is not the case when we get to the New Testament all of a sudden? Or that the New Testament God, to borrow an expression from more liberal teachings, is not a God of war? Or he's not a man of war? And so we just have a few minutes, but and once again, I'm sorry that we didn't necessarily arrive at a direct conclusion, because much like my historical teaching over the American Revolution, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you this is how you need to feel from an absolutely biblical point of view. So, do you feel that the Maccabean revolt was justified, and why would you say that? Or why do you think that it's not? Yes. Yep. Yeah, that's a good passage too. Yeah.
Trying to do was help to eliminate God's law.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, and it's a lot of it is conjecture because we wouldn't know for sure if God may use another means to preserve the law, and that if Jesus would have been born in a different environment without the Maccabean revolt, would that mean that God wasn't able to fulfill the law with Jesus? Of course, the answer is no. God can do whatever he wants within his will and his character. So, but, you know, to both of your points, it does seem as though God does bless the Maccabees for their actions. And the result, once again, we don't want to always say that the ends justify the means, but the result of the temple being reconsecrated, is that a good result? Yes, it is. And is Mattathias wrong for refusing? And, you know, going back to the beginning, is he wrong for doing that? No. So now the question is the manner in which the temple was reconsecrated, is that justified?
We're just going to be careful that we don't use history as a proof of what we see history as happening and saying, okay, since what you were saying, the end was good, that doesn't mean the means were right. The Bible says, surely the wrath of man, which is not justified, God will use for his benefit. Were the brothers of Joseph right in throwing him in a pit? Were they right? No, that was wrong.
But the end was good, so can we justify their means?
Yeah, he came to the end and said, you know, you meant it for evil, which God does not approve of, but God meant it for good. So we've got to be careful, though, that we go back in history and say, well, it turned out right, so it must have been good to start with.
Yeah,
no,
and I would
take anything and use it.
And if I was in a debate with somebody who, a Christian who believed that the American Revolution was not justified, I would not make my argument, I would not base my argument that it was justified on the, well, look at all the good stuff that happens. Well, that's not an argument. That's not an argument. Because it's almost a red herring, if you guys remember the logical fallacies that I went through. We're not arguing whether or not the result is good, we're arguing whether or not the revolution itself was justified. So there's two different points. Are we asking Are we asking the question, is it good that Mattathias refused? That's part of it, but if we're only basing justifying the entire revolt on those things, then I think we fail to appreciate what it is that we're actually asking. Yes.
Okay.